This is a recording of a sermon given at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.
The title of the sermon is The Dragons of Easter. It's indirectly inspired by the title of Carl Sagan's book, The Dragons of Eden. How is it that Draco and Tiamat and Hallelujah chorus all weave together? Imagine this. Came across a nice two little panel comic strip a few weeks back. There's a dragon. Dragon standing up, rearing on its rear legs, breathing fire. In its left hand, it holds a classic damsel in distress with a little tall hat. A knight faces the dragon. Raising his sword, he calls out, "Let her go, dragon! It's me you want!" In the next image, the dragon is curled peacefully, perhaps sleeping, curled around the knight, who has dropped his sword, taken off his helmet, and he's leaning back, sitting against the dragon, asleep, with a big smile on his face. And the princess is off in the distance, looking a little irritated. Took you a moment. That's the image of today. Curling up with the power of the universe, dangerous and mighty, curling up with it as a source of joy and gratitude, gladness and abundance, curling up with the dragons of Easter. This is the truth. There are two dragons that struggle for dominance in our minds and our hearts. One lives in the shadows of greed and violence, terrorism and criminal action. It inspires us to fear, to be afraid, to be worried, to hold on tightly to what little we have, certain that it will be taken away soon. The other dragon is generous and loving. The other dragon appears in surprising places, even in the very heart of the universe. This second dragon requires no murder, no blood sacrifice. This is the dragon of love. Which of those two dragons will you feed? Dragons are always images of power, fierce and brave. In America, dragons have recently become a little bit more like us, maybe even sweet and cute, from Puff the Magic Dragon now to How to Train Your Dragon. I always thought the title, How to Train Your Dragon, sounded like the title of a self-help book. In the ancient days, long ago, in the mythology of humanity, most things that were referred to as dragons or similar dragons were really just giant snakes, giant serpents. Later, they began to develop legs. Our cultures and imaginations gave them legs and wings, a little bit more like lizards or dinosaurs. Though the dinosaurs endured for millions of years, dragons have been with us perhaps since the beginning of our history, not quite as long as dinosaurs. I heard that dragons will never live as long as dinosaurs because the dinosaurs did not smoke. Thank you. I appreciate you laughing at really bad jokes. I don't always get laughter at home when I tell these jokes. So thank you. In Indo-European myths, the dragon, sometimes transmuted, was changed into something more selfish, more greedy. Perhaps the great beast gnawing at the roots of the universe. Killing the innocent, hoarding treasure, fighting the noble. In some places, like the Celtic lands or maybe St. Mary's High School, the dragons, go dragons, right? There can be images of nobility and courage and strength, fighting off enemies, but they're still fierce. They're still somewhat terrifying. But the dragons of Easter always evoke something more wonderful. The first dragon of Easter I wanted to hold up is the Lung dragon, the abundant power of life. In the Chinese zodiac, dragons come around once every 12 years, and everyone who's born that year is a dragon. There are images of dragons in Chinese culture, of people who are dragons. There are people of great nobility, of great character, of great power, of significance in their character. And our faith, our Unitarian faith, has always been one that at the very center held this desire and confidence in our ability to nurture human character, that even the most confused and sordid of us can find something of nobility to nurture and strengthen. And we find that even more intensified in certain individuals who are like dragons. There's a famous Chinese story of the philosopher Confucius, and Lao Tzu, the Taoist philosopher. And Confucius and Lao Tzu have a tea together, the two of them alone, being able to, these two great minds able to converse and listen to one another and share an afternoon with one another alone. And then when they came out, Confucius's followers asked him, "What was that like? What did you learn? What is Lao Tzu like?" And Confucius said, "I know that birds can fly, and I understand that fish can swim. I understand how beasts can run, but dragons, I shall never know how they ride the winds and clouds up into the sky. Today, I met Lao Tzu. What a dragon. I cannot reach him." This image of the nobility and the goodness and the wonder of life. For Lao Tzu had this confidence, this faith, that there was a way of shaping power at the heart of all things. And that was his life, and on that he staked his life. For that he lived. The dragons of China are always associated with rivers and with seas, with rains and water, because water is the source of life. Sometimes they hoard their wealth, but usually they pour it forth, sharing it with everything. This last few weeks, we have smelled the sweet, joyful power of rain, the trees and the flowers, not only the sun, but also the water, causing those buds to rise up and burst open. And that same power is within each of us. Life, abundant life. The dragon's wealth is yours. Smell it. Smell it in the air. Feel it in your skin. No matter how old you are, remember that water is life. And the dragons of Easter are releasing the waters to flow through the earth. In the Hebrew scriptures, a water dragon appears. It's the second of the dragons of Easter. It is Leviathan. Six times Leviathan appears in the Tanakh and the Hebrew scriptures. Three of those times is in the 41st chapter of Job. Twice he's in the Psalms. Once it's in the Isaiah. God's voice describes marvelously a Leviathan. Its back has rows of shields tightly sealed together, each one so close to the next that no air can pass between. Its snorting throws out flashes of light. Its eyes are like the rays of dawn. Flames stream from its mouth. Sparks of fire shoots out. Smoke pours from its nostrils as if from a boiling pot poured over burning reeds. Iron it treats like straw. Bronze like rotten wood. It churns the sea to froth. You would think the ocean had white hair. Nothing on earth is its equal, a creature without fear. It looks down on all who are haughty and proud. But in Job, the point of the beast is not to evoke fear and danger and death or evil. In Job, the point of the beast, the reason that it is raised up, is to evoke God's glorious mystery and power. For God asks, "Can you put a hook in Leviathan's mouth? Can you lead it about like a pet on a chain? If you could lay a hand on it, you would remember the struggle and never do it again. Any hope of subduing it is false. The mere sight of it is overpowering. Then who is able to stand against me?" Creator of Leviathan. The master of Leviathan, the one who can put a hook in its mouth and lead it about like a pet. Everything under heaven belongs to me, the God of the Bible says. So Leviathan is an echo and a reminder of the greater power of the universe that shaped this earth, that brought forth life on this earth, that brought forth in each of us a mind and a heart and a passion to see how glorious and amazing and fantastic every moment can be. The goal of life is to serve this truth, this power that created all things, the power that can control even Leviathan, the dragon. And as the Christian writer in 1 John said, God, that God is love. Leviathan was a primal being of the ancient waters, of the ocean and the deep. The Hebrew image of this dragon, of Leviathan, is deeply influenced by the Babylonian dragon, Tiamat. It's the third dragon of Easter. Tiamat in Babylonian mythology is creatrix. It's a cool little word, creatrix, a female creator, beginning of the gods and beginning of the universe. But in the Babylonian myth, there's a hero, Marduk, who fights Tiamat, cuts her to pieces, and then uses her body to fashion the world. Brian Swim took that mythological image, took that image from Babylon in the reading that we had this morning. The creation of the solar system from that protostar is like the use of Tiamat's body to shape the world. But here there is no murder, there is no necessary sacrifice of an evil being. Instead, the death is a natural result of a creative life lived well. For a star, a creative life lived well is the creation of heavier elements. But think in your own life. When you are creative, when you are working hard, maybe you're just forming a household, keeping your household together, keeping your house clean, making good meals, being the creatrix, creating memories for the people that you care about. Or maybe you're working in an office, working in your business, but you do that work well. You do it well because you care about it, because you want to add to the world, because you want to make the world better. There you are being a creative, something out of your body, out of your very physical self, working in the world. Happy to see some bonnets today. I always thought of bonnets as being crowns that celebrate life, celebrate our bodies, celebrate our being in Easter and the glories of the world are crowned with the Easter spirit. We are like Tiamat, lifted up. Her death is not required by some deity to appease his anger, but is the inevitable consequence of living well. In her death, the continuity of her lives go beyond that. Beyond her death, it's that continuity that gives the meaning of her existence. That protostar that bore forth everything from Jupiter to hummingbirds. And this brings me to the fourth dragon, which is Draco. In the story, Draco sees goodness and wants to be good. There's a moment in the movie, it's a funny movie, Dragonheart. Came out a couple decades ago. Feels like a long time ago now. And the funny thing about that movie is, one reviewer put it as, there's something wrong with a movie in which the dragon seems more real, more believable, more human than the human beings. They wrote the character of the dragon with a human struggle, an emotional struggle, whereas the other characters are a little bit flat and stilted. The knight Bowen is very much the knight Bowen, struggling with his desire to be a great knight, to serve the good. But the dragon has got a divided heart, like so many of us. At one point, the dragon, who's voiced by Sean Connery, and it was one of the very first movies that used motion capture technology to digitally recapture the expressions of Sean Connery's face. So these are projected into the dragon. So the dragon has a lot of emotion, both in the voice and in its expressions. And He says, long ago, when human beings were, when man was young, he said, and the dragon, already old, the wisest of our race took pity on man, and he gathered together all the dragons, making them vow to watch over man always. And at the moment of his death, the night became alive with the stars of the constellation. And thus was born the dragon's heaven. But when we die, not all dragons are admitted to this shining place. No, we have to earn it. And if we don't, our spirit disappears as if we never were. And that's why I shared my life force with a dying boy, so I would reunite men and dragons and ensure my safe, my place among the ancient brothers of the sky. But my sacrifice became my sin. To put your heart into something, to put your life into something, and then to see it go awry. Many of us know what this is like. To live our lives, to serve the world, to be a part of the world, and then to see that we are tangled up in its injustices and its inequities. To realize that our taxes and our money and our efforts sometimes are not being used to defend the good and uphold the righteous, but to perpetrate injustice and inequity in the world. A knight is sworn to valor, his heart only knows virtue, his blade defends the helpless, his might upholds the weak, and his word speaking only truth, his wrath undoes the wicked. Sometimes we don't speak the truth, or we know in our heart something other than virtue. And this is the moment when the dragon, still facing his ambivalent life, knowing that he has been a part of both nurturing good and evil in the world, lets himself die in order to end some evil, in order to stop something wrong, in order to express good and love. He reflects, for me, the image of that prophet, that teacher, Jesus of Nazareth. I do not believe that Jesus' death was required because of some mysterious requirement for blood on behalf of a deity. When I speak of God, I do not think of a person or a being who's planning out the universe and sets up impossible, strange, and mysterious requirements. Instead, I think of the power that has natural consequences. I think of the glory of life and the goodness of life. And the dragons of Easter are all about holding up that goodness that is in each of us, that is woven into the very fabric of the world, despite its evil, despite its ill, despite all that goes wrong. Jesus died not because God required it, but because the Roman Empire was a violent empire. It was built on the idea that victory and strength required the blood of one's enemies. It was a Roman requirement, not a divine one. And there's this struggle within Unitarianism. We always talk about doing good and wanting to do good. The Unitarians of the 1830s especially focused upon salvation by character as what we did that revealed our salvation, that ensured our salvation in the world, becoming good people through our actions. But these stories, with Draco and Jesus of Leviathan or Tiamat, remind us that there are complexities. And that the good and the evil are often mixed together and it's hard to sort them all out. And that all the actions in the world don't necessarily get rid of all the evil. All the good does not overwhelm it and get rid of it completely. And yet it still seems to endure, and sometimes there are unintended consequences. The great universalist preacher Hosea Ballou, who was contemporary of William Channing, beginning of Unitarianism, Channing, who inspired William Eliot to come here and found this church. Channing, often focused on good actions and doing good, inspired many people to do great things. But Hosea Ballou would critique him on this point. He felt that no child of God should be considered ever incorrigible, that anyone who was not perfectly good, whose actions had been bad, whose actions had been who had fallen way short of the ideals of Channing, could still be considered condemnable. And in homely language in 1851, he summed up his belief in God, who as a father loves all children. He said, your child has fallen into the mire and his body and garments are defiled. You cleanse your child. You array it in clean robes. And the query is, do you love your child because you have washed it? Or did you wash it because you loved it? The point is that we are already lovable. We are already bearers of the light of the great dragon Tiamat. We are already bearers of the gifts of the Lung dragons of water and moisture and abundant life. We are already the bearers of the gift of those who have sacrificed their lives to make the world a better place. Their deaths were not required as a sacrifice to appease an angry deity. Their deaths were simply a natural consequence of their lives. And we did not require young black men to be killed in the city just to awaken us to the need to be good. We already knew that the world was unjust. We already knew that the world was unfair. We were already working on behalf of goodness. It was the voices of those people who responded to the injustice that woke us up and moved us. And so it was with Dorothy Soule, the theologian, German theologian, who talked about Jesus. And she said, I don't, as they put it, believe in God, but to him I cannot say no. Hard as I try, take a look at him in the garden when his friends ran out on him and his face wet with fear or the spit of his enemies. In him I believe. I can't bear to abandon him to the great disregard for life, to the monotonous passing of millions of years, to the moronic rhythm of work, leisure, and work, to the boredom that we fail to dispel in cars, in beds, in stores. That's how it is, they say. What do you want? Uncertain and not uncritically. But I subscribe to the other hypothesis, which is his story. That's how it is, he said. For God is, and he staked his life on this claim. So the dragons remind us to stake our life on something great. We may call it on that very heart of the universe of goodness and love. We may call it God. We may call it the Tao. We may call it life and the beauty of the earth and the power of the human spirit. It does not matter what we call it. The dragons of Easter encourage us to celebrate it, to live it, to be glad for it, to serve it all the days of our lives.
You have been listening to a sermon recorded at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.